Stalin's sneering did not help Nadia, whose depression worsened. Yet there were also moments of touching tenderness. Nadia took an unaccustomed drink, which made her sick. Stalin put her to bed, and she looked up at him and said pathetically, "So you love me a little after all." We are left with a troubling picture of a husband and wife who alternated between loving kindness and vicious explosions of rage, both given to humiliating one another in public. Kaganovich again headed out of Moscow to crush dissent in the Kuban, ordering mass reprisals against the Cossacks and deporting 15 villages to Siberia. Kaganovich called this the resistance of the last remnants of the dying classes, leading to a concrete form of the class struggle. The classes were dying, all right. One witness saw women and children with distended bellies, turning blue, still breathing, but with vacant, lifeless eyes. And corpses. Corpses in ragged sheepskin coats and cheap felt boots. Corpses in peasant huts, in the melting snow of old Vologda, under the bridges of Kharkov. Iron Lazar arranged an array of executions of grain hoarders, and was back in time for the fatal holiday dinner for the anniversary of the revolution. On the 7th of November, the potentates took the salute from atop Lenin's newly completed grey marble mausoleum. Nadia took her place in the parade as a delegate of the academy. Many people saw her that day. She did not seem either depressed or unhappy. She marched past, raising her oval face towards the leaders. Afterwards, she met up with Vasily and Artyom on the tribune to the right of the mausoleum, and bumped into Khrushchev, whom she had introduced to Stalin. She looked up at her husband in his greatcoat, but like any wife, she worried that Stalin's coat was open. "My man didn't take his scarf, he'll catch cold and get sick," she said. But suddenly she was struck with one of her agonizing headaches. After the parade, the boys requested the housekeeper to ask Nadia if they could spend the holiday at Dubalova. It was easier to persuade the housekeeper than tackle the severe mother. Next morning, the boys were driven off to Dubalova. Stalin worked, as usual, in his office, where he was shown the transcript of another anti-Stalin meeting of the old Bolsheviks, Smirnov and Eismont, one of whom had asked, "Don't tell me there's nobody in this whole country capable of removing him." Their arrest was ordered. Then Stalin and his colleagues walked over to the Voroshilovs for dinner. Sometime in the early hours, Nadia took the Mauser pistol that her brother Pavel had given her and lay on the bed in her room. Suicide was a Bolshevik death. Adolf Iofer, the Trotskyite, protested against Stalin's defeat of the oppositions by shooting himself in 1929. She raised the pistol to her breast and pulled the trigger once. No one heard the voice of that tiny feminine weapon. Kremlin walls are thick. Her body rolled off the bed onto the floor. It was clear that Nadia had committed suicide, but Molotov, Kaganovich, and her godfather, Yanukitza, got Stalin's agreement that this could not be announced publicly. It would be taken as a political protest. They would announce she had died of appendicitis. Yanukitza drafted the announcement of her death, and then wrote a letter of condolence, to be published the next day in Pravda, signed by all the leaders' wives, and then the leaders themselves. "Our close friend, a person with a wonderful soul, young, vigorous and devoted to the Bolshevik Party and the revolution. Even this death was seen by these singular dogmatists in terms of Bolshevism." Stalin asked Kaganovich, the Politburo's best speaker, to give the funeral oration. Even that energetic bulldozer of a man, fresh from shooting droves of innocent Kuban Cossacks, was daunted by the burden of giving such a speech in front of Stalin himself. But as with so many other macabre chores, Stalin asked, and I did it. The death of Nadia from appendicitis was broken to the children out at Dzhubalova. Artyom was distraught, but Vasily never recovered. Svetlana, 6, did not grasp this finality. Voroshilov, who was so kind in all matters outside politics, visited her but could not talk for weeping. The other children were driven to Moscow, Svetlana remaining in the country until the funeral. When the body was removed from the apartment, sometime on the morning of the 10th, Stalin walked beside it, wearing no gloves in the freezing cold, clutching at the side of the coffin with tears running down his cheeks. Vasily and Artyom arrived at Stalin's flat, where Pavel, Zhenya, and Nadia's sister Anna took turns watching over the widower who remained in his room and would not come out for dinner. The gloomy apartment was pervaded by whispers. Artyom's mother arrived, and foolishly told her son the spellbinding truth about the suicide. Artyom rashly asked the housekeeper about it. Both he and his mother were reprimanded. During the night, the body was delivered to the Hall of Columns, close to Red Square and the Kremlin. It was to be the scene of some of the great trials and lying in states of Stalin's rule. The three smaller children were taken to the hall, where Nadezhda Aleluyeva Stalin lay in an open casket, her round face surrounded by bouquets, her bruises exquisitely powdered and rouged away by Moscow's macabre maestros. Svetlana was led up to the coffin. She cried, and they rushed her out. Yanukitsa comforted her, dispatching her back to Zubalova. She only learned of the suicide a decade later, incongruously, from the Illustrated London News. Stalin arrived accompanied by the Politburo, who stood guard around the catafalque, a duty to which they were to grow accustomed in the deadly years ahead. Stalin was weeping. Vasily left Artyom and ran forward towards Stalin, and hung on to his father, saying, "Papa, don't cry," to a chorus of sobs from Nadia's family and the hard men of the Politburo and Cheka. The Vosht approached the coffin with Vasily holding on to him. Stalin looked down at this woman who had loved, hated, punished, and rejected him. "I'd never seen Stalin cry before," said Molotov. But as he stood there beside the coffin, the tears ran down his cheeks. "She left me like an enemy," Stalin said bitterly. But then Molotov heard him say, "I didn't save you." They were about to nail down the coffin when Stalin suddenly stopped them. To everyone's surprise, he leaned down, lifted Nadia's head, and began to kiss her ardently. This provoked more weeping.